And of course, that later on helped me in my coaching career, that I had a good eye for the tactics. And you pretty much get the information from your coach before the game, and then you run the game on the court. Of course, there are some timeouts that the coach can make adjustments. But a lot of things are coming from the center player, the playmaker.
On the show today, Icelandic professional athlete Dagur Sigurdsson, here to talk about the sports culture in his country, his experience playing handball at the highest level, and his role as head coach of the Japanese national men's Olympic handball team.
You're listening to the Run Your Life podcast with host Andy Vassily.
When I reflect back on early days in my life, I can clearly remember being a young boy looking up at the huge world map that I had posted on my bedroom wall. I loved nothing more than scanning every part of the map, looking at the names of the countries and the cities within those countries. It led to a deep fascination and curiosity about what life was like in those countries around the world, and what the people were like, and what the country itself looked like. In particular, I can clearly recall seeing this tiny little island country just to the right of Greenland, way up on top of the map. It was the country Iceland, and this country became a fascination for me. And as a young boy, I literally thought it was called Iceland, because it must be under snow and ice all year round. I remember trying to find any information I could about Iceland to read, with most of the information being from the World Almanac. As years passed and I grew older, I learned more about the country and its people, more specifically, the love of the outdoors and sport that many Icelanders embrace. Many listeners of my podcast probably do not know that my family and I spent nearly 10 years living in Hiroshima, Japan. Japan is truly a special place for us, and in 2004, just after the birth of my first son, Eli, my wife and I met an Icelandic couple also living in Hiroshima. Although they left Japan a couple months after we met them, we got to know them quite well during that time. Their names were Ingeborg and Dagur Sigurdsson. Dagur and I went on many long runs together and chatted about our lives, and I found out that he was a professional handball player and was in his last few months training for the Summer Olympics that were being held in Greece that year. He was a member of the Icelandic national handball team, and he and his wife and young family at the time were moving on from Japan, and Dagur was going to take on the role of a player coach for an Austrian professional handball team. Dagur would go on to represent his country in the Olympics in Greece in 2004, and over the years develop himself into a world-renowned coach in the sport. He spent time in Austria before going on to coach professionally in Germany and lead the German men's national handball team in the World Championship and the Olympics. As you will see in this episode, Dagur has a distinct coaching style that really sets him apart from others. And as you listen to the episode, you will learn about what he believes is most important in leading and coaching others, and how he strives to deeply connect with those around him in order to lift them up and push them to be their very best. Although I haven't seen Dagur in nearly 20 years, it was really awesome to reconnect with him and hear more about his journey, the journey that he's been on since our days together in Japan. And in knowing Dagur, he's a real family man and is deeply committed to his loved ones. And as a coach and mentor to his athletes, he is equally committed to really helping them to strive for excellence. And through his leadership, he believes that context is everything. And we go into that in this episode, because every team that he's coached and played on there's a different context, a different team culture. And to him, I think that's one of his strengths in knowing him and understanding his journey, is his ability to read that context and culture and make decisions around what is best based on the context and culture of the team. And as a leader, he really believes in deeply understanding the context of the organization in order to put the leadership moves necessary into action that will continue to spark growth and progress. So those were some of the things that we really touched on in our episode today. Dagur is now on a mission as the Japanese men's Olympic handball coach. And he really is on a mission because he chose to sign an 8-year deal so that he could really commit to taking that team to the next level. And he recently had the opportunity to lead his team in the Tokyo Olympics, and he'll talk about that as well in this episode. He learned a lot from that, that he's putting certain plans into action to get ready for the Paris Games in 2024. Everything he's doing now is about helping to plant the seeds for slow and continuous growth over time in order to put his athletes in the best position possible for competition. As well, he's really deeply committed to spreading the love of the game of handball in Japan. So I know that because he has that past in Japan playing professionally, and he's now coaching the national team, he's really a part of what's happening on the handball scene and really wants to promote the game. So it was great to reconnect with Dagur, and I hope you find value in our discussion today. And with that, let's jump right into my discussion with European handball legend Dagur Sigurdsson.
Dagur, it is amazing to see you again. And the way I start my podcasts, my listeners will always hear a little bit about my guest when they hit play. So they will have already heard a couple minutes about you and your life and your journey. But right, we're jumping into the conversation now. And what I want the guests to know is that we haven't seen each other in almost 20 years. This is amazing to have you on the podcast. And I really appreciate your time today. And it's great to reunite with you.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me.
So I talked before we hit record, we just caught up because it's been so long. But you've got such a great journey. And we're going to unpack a lot of that in the conversation today, but I want to start with me as a young boy growing up in Canada, and I was fascinated with the world map, and I studied the world map. It was on my wall in the room, like as a 10-year-old, and I remember looking at different places in the world, and Iceland was one country I always saw as a boy that was just completely mysterious to me. And I knew it existed, and I knew it was a very small country, but I would like to ask you, like, what was it like for you as a boy growing up in Iceland? What was life like for you, and what was your perception of the outside world?
Well, first of all, I think people will know the small village kind of upbringing that you automatically get in Iceland, because we're there are not so many people living here. It's a 300,000 population, but we have a really big, huge country. So the land is enormous, and you have very strong connection with nature. You just need a 15 or 20 minutes drive, then you are absolutely in the nature of Iceland. And we start very early on to learn about how to survive and how to fish and how to walk and go outdoors and this kind of things. We learn from early age. Most of the people here have a cottage or a small house in the countryside. So a lot of the weekends you go there with your parents in the beginning. My upbringing was just full with sports. My father was a soccer goalkeeper, a legend for the club. He played for the national team of Iceland. And my mother was a team handball player. And they were both very successful and very well known in the community. So there was a little bit of a positive pressure to go into sports for the three of us. We have three brothers. It ended up that I played both sports, both team handball and soccer until I was 18 or 19 years old.
Hey, Doug, just a quick question. Which were you? Like, were you the first brother, second brother, or oldest brother?
I'm a second brother. I have one older brother, 2 years older than one who's 7 years younger.
Very different personalities, or the same kind of temperament?
Same kind of temperament, I would say. Different. Yeah, a little bit different, but we are still really good friends. Mm-hmm. Our hobbies are not so much in sports anymore. We listen to a lot of music together. We play music together when we can. Our youngest brother is a great musician in a band called Monotown.
Monotown.
And they are, you know, doing music on a professional level. So we are privileged to be around a lot of artists and creative people today. About the upbringing, like I said, we were going to practices in our club, and then in between we went to our schoolyard and played any kind of sport: basketball, handball, football, soccer, just what we could spend time with our friends. Mm-hmm. So a lot of late nights. And then, of course, we followed mostly the English soccer league, the Premier League of soccer in England, Manchester United, Liverpool, those kinds of games we watched always. And then when I was a teenager, I started to watch NBA a lot. This was the Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson era. And we used to stay up all night to watch the games live. So just a lot of sports, any kind,
that's great.
I
remember, because you and I met in Japan, so that's the backstory. And we met in Hiroshima, Japan, and we met right at the tail end of your time in Japan. And I was so sad that we had only met each other for about a month or a month and a half before you left. Right. So we went for a lot of runs. And you knew that I was a quarterback in football, and I was like, oh, I want to throw you the football. You're the only person. There's the football. There's the football. He's got a football in his hand that I gave him many years ago. You were the only person I ever threw a football to from Iceland, and you could catch everything. I just threw it as hard as I could at you, and you could catch everything. But I had the privilege of meeting your parents, and we played golf together. And they came over to Japan, and I brought them out to the course that I played. And I don't think you were there with us playing because you were training, maybe, but I had a great afternoon with your parents and got to know them really well. And when I think of Iceland, I've always been fascinated by this community feel. And I had the privilege to interview the head coach of the 2017 Euro Cup, you know, the team that advanced really far. And I can't say his name, but can you say his name for the audience?
Heimir Hallgrímsson. Yes. Yeah, the soccer coach of the Icelandic team.
Yeah. And he was brilliant. And he also, because I asked him about that, I told him that I knew you, and I asked him that about like what makes Iceland so great at sports, considering that there's only a community of 300,000 or 330,000. And he really talked about this idea of connection, and that it's not a one sport culture, it's multiple sports. So the skills of sport transcend and can be applied across multiple domains. And I came across this quote that I want to read to you about Iceland. And it said the quote is, "The community spirit enables the country's athletes to closely monitor each other's progress and thus obtain additional motivation to perform better than the rival, who is also likely to be their friend or relative." Yeah. So does that quote resonate with you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, well, what we learned very early on, we go to our clubs. This is often connected with your neighborhood or connected with your family tradition or something like that. So we go to our clubs and we become club person. You know, we don't change the team. Almost in your life, you don't change the team. So we are really team-minded people when it comes to, you know, your roots. You have to have those roots. And this transparency then into the national team, when we play there together, this you can see how the spirit of the team, when you get all the top players from those clubs then together, that they bring this kind of team mentality with them. And this is something I think different from what I've learned in Germany, where I was bringing my kids up. Then you had a competition very early on in the stage of the kids, mm-hmm. and the best kids went directly to a better club, and they left the kids behind that were not so good. But that meant that the kids were already jumping ship to get almost like a career jumping, what you expect later on, but they were doing this with the kids. So you never develop this kind of team spirit. We always, when we were growing up, we always had somebody on the team who was not that good at sports, but he was a good guy in the dressing room, or he was an important person in the friendship. So we always had this kind of upbringing that maybe we are not the best team, but we are good friends here, and the best players will play a little bit more, or they will carry the team. But those other guys are just as important for the club. Beautiful. Because when we finish playing, we're going to be all sitting at the same table at the club, and going to the games together or something like that. So this is, I think, helps the national teams of Iceland that we have really strong team spirit mentality. And also for the coaches, what I was thinking about later on when I started coaching is that those coaches that have those club teams, they are used to trying to maximize what they have, you know, they don't always have the perfect team. So they try to maximize how they can have those three good guys, but those two guys, I somehow have to, you know, hide the weaknesses of them and use the strength of the good guys. Mm-hmm. So we learned that as coaches or early on as well. So, for example, in team handball, we have lot of Icelandic coaches on a really high level working in the best clubs in the countries here in Europe,
so that they can kind of read the player's ability and then exactly, make a nice mix. And one of the things I do a lot of reading from various fields, and I came across the work of a great speaker. Her name is Margaret Heffernan. So she's a top speaker. She's done a lot of TED Talks. And what she studies is this idea of what makes any organization successful. It doesn't matter if it's sports, if it's business, you know, medical field, whatever. What makes a highly successful team? And then she shared in one of her TED Talks this idea. It was called the Super Chicken Study. Okay. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of the Super Chicken Study?
No.
Okay. So
give it to me.
Okay. So there was a Yale professor who studied chickens for years. And what he wanted to do was to create two groups of chickens at a farm. He had created a flock of chickens and then observed them over 8 generations. And then at the end of 8 generations, he basically took the strongest chickens, you know, the chickens genetically strong, you know, powerful chickens that were passed down. You know, he took this flock and he created one group of chickens with them. In the other group, he took the average chicken, right? Just the average chicken, you know, nothing special about the chicken. And then he put this separate flock in a different farm. And then he observed how they interacted over the next 6 generations of chickens. Okay. So you would think that the super chicken flock would be powerful and strong and making, you know, strong chicken babies, right? Yeah. Strong chicks. Yeah. But the truth was that when he went back after six generations, he just left it alone after that. He didn't try to interfere in any way. And he came back a couple of years later after they had gone through several generations. And what he found was that the super chicken flock had basically killed itself. They got into fights. They pecked each other. There was no feathers left. And there was only a couple little weak chickens left. Whereas the average chicken flock was thriving, fully feathered, strong, and just continuing to do great work as a chicken family, you know? So she uses that story as a metaphor for organizations. And what you're describing in the Iceland experience is this idea. It really is the average chicken flock working together to create the best scenario possible. And so I just wanted to share that study with you, but it's an interesting study because it does apply to team sports. So when you think about team sport and your experience, of course you need talent and strength, but what do you think is the real winning recipe for pro sports, regardless if it's handball or basketball or whatever it is?
You know, when you have the top athletes, there is such a small margin in, and this is a team sport. So the element of the team is really big. And then I would say attitude is the most important thing, and it's more important than a little bit of talent on top. Much better if you have a team that has the right attitude and they can get together and develop friendship and develop a mentality, winning mentality together. This is nothing new in sport, that attitude is important, but I think because it's also this team sport we have, it's a little bit like basketball. We have seven field players. Mm-hmm. So the group is usually 18 to 20 people on a team. So it's a close team, and it's really difficult if you get personal problems and inside this small group. Attitude is extremely important.
For the tactics.
Having said that we are speaking about the top athletes. I would always take a little bit
game, and then you run the game
more better attitude on top than a little bit more quality or skills.
So how do you, as a coach, I want to go into your career a bit, but before we get there, as a coach, how have you learned to help not train positive attitude, but how do you learn to develop a culture where attitude is very important in the team culture setting?
I learned a lot about this when I went from being a club coach in Berlin, where I had my team in the Bundesliga, German Bundesliga. And in that environment, I could train every day with my team, and I could help them develop, be a little bit quicker, jump a little bit higher, throw a little bit faster. We could drill the tactics again and again and again and again and again, because I had them every day in training. And then I changed from national from club coach into a national team coach. Mm-hmm. And in this situation, I just get them for 1 week, play one game. And then I have to wait again until it comes to national team week. And then I get the national team players and we play. And then maybe in January, there's a world championship or something. And then I have a preparation that is very limited with the team. So obviously I cannot help them run faster or jump higher or throw faster in this short time of period. So I concentrated more about this attitude thing. And this is just a way you can go any way with it. You know, you can, and I choose this attitude thing. I took a Detroit Pistons from the bad boy area.
Bill Laimbeer.
I took that.
Yeah, exactly.
I used that on my team when I took over the German national team. And I told them about this story about those were young guys. Oh, I was the only guy who knew about the bad boys. So I told them the story about the bad boys. I showed them the documentary and,
They were bad too. Because they were bad.
They were bad. Yeah. And my team was a little bit, you know, like sons-in-law kind of guys, you know, nice guys, you know, too nice. And, they didn't have those superstars and, they didn't have this attitude. So I thought, okay, maybe I can collect them all into this bad boys idea. And they bought into it. We started to post our dressing room with Detroit Pistons photos, and we listened to the music from this period. And a lot of things, all the new players that came into the team, they had to watch the documentary first before they came to our first training, things like that, you know, small details. And step by step, nobody knew about it, that this was our aim. Step by step, the team just got aggressive and we developed this mentality. This meant also that we didn't, you know, sometimes we were eating, we didn't have a pasta or salad or something super healthy because we were the bad boys. We just had a burger and a beer maybe after the training just to give the tone, you know, we are the bad boys. Yeah. We can be out of the box, you know, there's nothing, it's not going to stop on this one.
Yeah.
So fast forwarding maybe 2.5 years later, we were the European champions with the youngest team. We had the youngest team at the European Championship, but we had a lot of injuries in the tournament. We lost probably 4 or 5 guys, important guys, on the way to the final. But somehow we always had this bad boys attitude, and the dressing room was pumped with macho thoughts and macho behavior, you know. But in this moment, it worked very, very well. And
that's awesome.
This is also an interesting story because then a couple of years later, I take over as a Japanese national coach. And as you know, this is a no-go behavior in Japan. So, you know, you're not going to make a copy-paste kind of program with that.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. And before going to the Japan experience, because I definitely have a question for you about the difference between, I'm looking up here because I have the question right here on the wall for you. But before going to that question, I want you to define yourself as a player. So define your playing style. Because again, I remember throwing the American football as hard as I could at you. And I could throw hard. And I remember the first couple catches, you were kind of like trying to get used to the spin. And then you're like, okay, I got this. Just squeeze a little harder as it comes in. And then you just caught everything after that. So very talented in terms of, from what I saw from my perspective as an outsider, you know, great hands, strong, could move fast, agile. But could you describe yourself as a player and your playing style and how your playing style evolved throughout your professional career?
Yeah, I think, I mean, if we compare it to basketball or something that people maybe know a little bit better, I was a point guard or a playmaker or, you know, like a quarterback kind of thing in football. So calling the plays, having good sense for the whole organization.
193
centimeters.
Okay, I can't do my calculation right now, but I think 6'3", 6'4", yeah, around there.
Yeah,
okay.
Something like, yeah, so maybe not like a score machine, but I could score my goals on my own also, but more like a playmaker type. And of course, that later on helped me in my coaching career, that I had a good eye for the tactics. And you pretty much get the information from your coach before the game, and then you run the game on the court. Of course, there are some timeouts that the coach can make adjustments. But a lot of things are coming from the center player, the playmaker.
So describe playmaking, because playmaker is a common term in multiple sports.
Yeah,
so
right.
I can, from an American football perspective, I can understand a playmaker. I was a playmaker as a quarterback, meaning that I was very non-traditional and I could improvise, and I threw sidearm and I could, you know, I didn't stay still when I threw, whereas most traditional tall quarterbacks would stay still behind the guys. I was always like running all over the place, trying to make plays, improvising.
Yeah.
So when you think of handball, describe what you mean by playmaker.
Yeah. I think it's closer to basketball than it's closer to football, because the size of the team is also a little bit more, you can oversee it a little bit better. You have five guys with you on the court, and then you have a goalie as a seventh member. So, it's easy to communicate, and it's easy to run the play. You know, the tactics are not so far away from basketball as well. You know, you get the screens, you get players coming through, opening up spaces, getting one-on-one situations, two against two situations are the plays you want to get in handball as well. So we had our friend Bruno who was playing with me in Japan at that time, that you know well. So my job would be to give him a good cross that he can make his three steps and have a good jump in the air and score a goal. So I make the play for him, but every now and then I have to break through myself to keep myself dangerous, so that the defense is going to react to move.
Yeah.
But I'm more or less already planned where the ball is going next three, four plays. So every attack is a setup.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, so again, keeping the defense honest by always infusing yourself in there when they let their guard down.
Exactly.
Yeah. Awesome. And when you think of playing in Japan, so I think probably I would guess that one of the strengths that you bring to, because you're the national coach for the Japanese men's team. You just finished the Olympics in Tokyo.
Yeah.
But having played there for three seasons, you got a sense of the Japanese style. So I would think that would serve you well as a coach. But, you know, that was a long time ago when you played. And my experience playing American football in Japan, and I can just tell you in a nutshell, is that my Japanese team, incredible athletes. They could catch everything. They were fast. They were technically sound, you know, but as a quarterback, I'm improvising and I'm a playmaker, but they wanted plays on paper. They wanted to see the actual play on paper and what they needed to do. And when it came to game situations, I was flipping between plays in the huddle. And I was like, okay, let's do this. I'm actually literally flipping through pages right now to demonstrate what that was like. But it drove me crazy. And I was like, and I would throw the playbook down and I would get angry and I would frustrate it in half Japanese, half English. And I would say, just go over there because that defender is not so strong and we got this strong. And I would try to explain it, but eventually they adapted to my style. And then we developed an audible system, which was amazing, is that we didn't have any plays at all. We would go up to the line and I would use colors and numbers in Japanese. Yeah. And then they developed an understanding of it. And we advanced to the national championship and we lost in the Tokyo Dome. And then their feedback was, we weren't prepared enough. We want plays on paper. So they wanted to go back to plays on paper, and it drove me nuts. But that is the way that the Japanese sometimes think is very mechanical. So that's what I want to ask you now is the question I have is like going from Germany, bad boys, badasses, to then going back to Japan to coach the national Japanese men's, handball team. What did you learn and how did you adjust and how did you try to get them to think in the way that you needed them to think to compete on the global level?
Right. It's a huge, huge step. You know, you cannot compare those two worlds at all, almost, because the European side of it, especially Germany, this is the second biggest sport in Germany, handball, after soccer and before basketball in Germany, handball is the number two sport. And they have the Bundesliga and they have a Champions League of Europe. So those guys are playing over 100 games a year and have a world championship and European championship, one of both every year. So those guys have extremely big experience, a lot of experience in big games and under pressure situations. On the other hand, Japan has a small league of 10 clubs. And those clubs don't change at all between years. They get one rookie and the oldest guy must finish his career. Yeah. So there is always the teams look very similar every year. So everything goes on automatic and the league becomes really friendly and there are not so aggressive play like you see in Europe. So this was the biggest challenge. Like I told you, with the bad boys in Germany, this was also my coaching style with them. I cut down the long meetings with video analyzing. And of course, we did it before big games in World Championship. But to analyze everything we do in the training and because the players playing that much every year, they were closer to burnout than being some kind of fresh, you know. Mm-hmm. So they just cannot take in any more than just necessary, and they are always playing. The next game is always the most important one, and they are always under pressure. So that was one of my way with the German team, was to cut down a lot of things around the team. I cut down a lot of the specialists. We had a goalkeeper specialist. I took him out. That we took public relation out of the team. We took weight training specialist out of the. I mean, I cut down the staff hugely. On the other hand, when I came to Japan, I'm doing all of that, and I'm doing double of it. You know, so they used to play 10 games a year, the national team. When I took over, we play 30 games a year. So I'm putting in now a lot of effort to, we have long meetings, long teaching seminars. We videotape every training. They can watch it on their iPhones. They can see what I'm going to do in the training in the evening on their iPhones in the morning. We measure everything they eat. We analyze everything they eat, every meal. A lot of those things, we are doing everything to maximum, and we have unbelievable facilities in Tokyo. So my staff is sometimes up to 15, 20 people around the team. So it's almost like a one-on-one coaching. Mm-hmm. We have a group of 20 players with staff of 15 to 20. Especially now before the Olympic, it was extreme because we were in a difficult situation because of COVID and Olympics in our own country. So it was everything was done as well as somehow possible.
And how do you teach them to be innovative and improvise? And is it more of a set play style, or are you able to teach them? Maybe, you know, Japan has changed over the last 20 years. I don't know, but have you been able to work with them to improvise and think on the spot?
But you know the Japanese quite well. Mm-hmm. And when I tell you that, my playmaker in the Japanese handball national team comes from Okinawa. Okay. It's not going to be a surprise for you.
Okay, right? Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Those people are a little bit more laid back. They're a little bit more creative. And he's that kind of guy.
Awesome.
So there's a player from Okinawa, really good handball player, and he's my playmaker for the national team.
Mm-hmm.
So he carries a little bit this personalities we were talking about in the playmaker situation. He is creative, and he takes a little bit more risk than the traditional Japanese Tokyo, Osaka, and Nagoya area. You know, it's a little bit more uptight.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, that's cool. So what I want to ask you about is I have a quote for you from my last guest, Dr. Michael Gervais, and we talked about him, the sports psychologist. And one of his quotes, having worked with, you know, many professional athletes around the world, some of the best in the world, what he believes is that optimal performance begins with a maximum frustration. And while flow is an incredible high, it can start with a deep low. So can you talk as a professional athlete and then coaching players, they're going to have times of discomfort and frustration. Yeah. And what the most important thing is what they do with those experiences, because it's a needed part of the process to grow and learn. So how do you get your players, you as an athlete, how did you sit with discomfort and frustration and low points in order to grow and get better? And you as a coach, how do you allow players or help players to sit with discomfort and frustration in order to keep getting better and better and reflecting on their own performance?
Right. That was a big issue for me when I took over in Japan, because the team was not good.
Yeah.
And they only played 10 games a year. So they would lose maybe 7 of them. And that was not a big problem. They maybe won 3 of them against weaker nations.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you start to play 30 games a year and you lose 21, then you're losing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So this was very important in the process to learn how to play. But you must also find motivation that those results build the atmosphere. And so what I tried to do was make smaller goals than victory or winning the games. So just smaller goals would be maybe that our defense would just get those that many goals on us, or in those games we want to make those 10 fast break goals or something, like, you know, just a little bit smaller. At the same time, we had to take extremely big steps physically. So those were also goals, to get extra muscles, get the fat down, be quicker, be stronger, so they could see, okay, we are getting physically better here. Our defense is not that bad. Okay, we lost the game, but somehow we were still getting some of our goals, even though we were losing the games. So that was a point that took maybe 1.5-2 years, that we were losing a lot of the games, but trying to keep the mental side positive with those smaller goals.
Right. So when you think about what you just said, is this idea of, there's a great book called Atomic Habits. Have you heard of that?
No.
Okay. It's by James Clear. And I think you would love the book, because the whole concept of the book is 1% better. Don't go for 50% better or 60% better. And it's this idea of an aggregation of marginal gains, meaning a little better all the time consistently is better than 30% better all of the sudden, and then not so good for a few months, and then another 10% better. It's this idea of marginal gains over time. And it's built around, the book is written around the philosophy of the British cycling coach who took over the cycling coach. Britain had not won a gold medal in cycling in 100 years in the Olympics or something. And this British coach took over, and he was about this idea of 1% better. So it was the littlest things, sleeping a little better every night, making sure that your bike, just every part of the bike is a little bit better. You don't need top parts on the bike. You just need it to function a little better. Everything was a little better mentality. But over time, 3-4 years, then the British cycling team became one of the best in the world. So what you're saying is this idea of like focusing on the small goals. And then the other thing is this idea of Martin Seligman is a famous psychologist. He created a movement, positive psychology, which is don't look at the things that are not working and everything that's going wrong. Look at what's working and what you're doing well. So when you combine the idea of micro goal setting with that idea of look for what's working and what's good and what you're doing well, rather than what you're not doing well, it's a recipe for long-term success.
Yeah.
Does that resonate with you?
Absolutely, yeah. And this is also the reason I did a long-term contract with Japan. My contract in Germany was not that long. I think it was 3 years contract I did, and I could have stayed on, but I did a almost 8 years contract with in Japan because I knew that it would be baby steps and it would be a hard way. And if I was coming in for 1 or 2 years and promising something, a quick fix, it would not work out. I knew it was gonna, I almost knew that the generation was not in the team at the moment. They would grow into the environment that we want them to grow into, where they can learn. You know, first I had to change the team that was there, and then those guys who are coming into that environment, they would learn from the beginning how we want to have things, how professional we have to be, and all those cliches that you need to have.
Tokyo, just give us a summary of Tokyo, how you felt about how the team did, and what the team learned, and what you're going to focus on moving into Paris 2024.
Well, there was a world championship in January, and then the Olympics were moved behind that and started end of July. It was a little bit pity that we did extremely well at the World Championship. So we went on a little bit on the fly, and it was a little bit difficult to keep the heads down, especially around the team and the environment around the players. Everybody got really hyped up. Big tournament coming up, and we did that well at the World Championship. So that was a little bit tricky. We did quite well. We won our game against Portugal, which was a key game, and there was only one or two goals difference than we would have proceeded into the final eight.
Good.
But we were one goal away, and it was the last goal of the tournament. So we came up one goal short. The team did extremely well, but it could have been better. We also made mistakes around the team in the building up to the Olympics because of the COVID situation. Japan was extremely strict. They didn't allow any athletes to come. We didn't have any preparation matches before the Olympic Games because it was closed. We could not go away, because if we came then back, we would have to go 14 days into quarantine. So it was extremely difficult time without the preparation games, and then the all the teams from Europe came all really well prepared, and it was successful, but it was not the the dream we could have maybe had.
So how are you now moving forward? Like kibishi, ne? Like Japan is so strict. You know, kibishi.
I'm extremely you know, I'm really excited about it. For me, this was not about the Olympics in the because if it was only about the 2020 Olympics, I would have stayed with Germany because I had the chance to win the Olympics with Germany. But I'm in Japan because, first of all, I like Japan. I like to be there.
Yeah,
it's for me, it's a quality of life. But also, I like to help the Japanese handball all together, not with a quick fix, not with a one good result. I want to just do it so it's going to be organic and sustainable. And it's going to be, you know, when I finish, there's going to be, as we will still see the world Japanese team at the World Championship. So that was the main reason. That's why I did 8 years contract, because I decided myself I have to make a contract there so that if I finish after that, I will be happy and I can stop coaching if I feel like that. But now I don't know if I'm going to continue coaching or not after the Paris Olympics. And it's going to be extremely, extremely difficult to qualify for the Olympics. So that task is enough. But we are getting a really exciting new generation that came into this team, and they are a little bit more professional and they want to play in Europe. And they are, you know, now we have five or six players who are already playing in Europe, and getting that experience and then back into our team is going to help us extremely in the next years.
Awesome. Awesome. So cool to hear. And I'll definitely follow the progress. And just to kind of close the show, are you on social media at all?
Not that much, you know.
Okay.
I have a Facebook, but I don't check in that much.
Okay. Okay. So, just thinking about your biggest hope, because I heard you say that beyond 2024, you might stop coaching. You're not sure what you're going to do. You're still young. I think you're 40, 47, 48, right? How old are you?
Right. Yeah. 48.
So when you think a little more long term, what is it that you're hoping for? What would you like to focus on?
I've been lucky with my career in that sense that I haven't planned that much. It was coincidences. I of course, as an athlete, I worked really hard. As a coach, I did that as well. You know, I've been working as a speaker for companies in Germany after the European Championship in 2016. So I'm still flying over to Germany to make seminars and making keynote speeches for the companies there. Of course, they follow my career.
Yeah,
still in Germany.
Around what themes? So, you know, what are the themes that you bring to your talks?
That is more or less this mentality, a little bit the story of the bad boys sometimes, just how more or less just my stories, you know, it's not so much theory, just
resilience.
Yeah, also they are interested in the cultural differences between Japan and Germany and what kind of obstacles are in the way for me. And I cannot tell them what obstacles they have. You know, this is a daily work at the big companies. So I'm just telling them, this is what happened to me when I started there. This, when I took over as a national coach of Germany, those were the problems I faced. Yeah, I'm not that kind of bucket list guy. I don't plan. I'm really happy with what I've achieved and where I am today. Having my family in Iceland, my kids are healthy, and everything is playing out really nicely. So it's not that important for me. The career is not that important for me as it was before. Mm-hmm. So I know I can work in this field for a long time, and I will probably get paid until I die coaching handball because of the status and the name. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to do that. I want to work in this field if there is something that calls me. You know, if there is something that I'm passionate about, and that could be some other national team, that could be my home team, Iceland, or that could be just at the local club or something like that. You know, it just has to be the right timing and the right feeling. And it has served me well to take those gut feeling when I've done it. So just going to take it as it comes, not planning anything.
Awesome. Awesome. And, you know, I'm doing a talk tomorrow at the university here to a group of PhD students. And it's around this idea of to be the best that you can be, you really have to tap into what your purpose is. And it's not that you have to understand the answer, but you have to at least try to be figuring it out along the way. And I'm doing a lot of reading around brain neurology and the way the brain works when it comes to goal setting. And, you know, everything you just said kind of resonates, because the research that I've done revolves around this idea that we have to stay creative. We have to think about what's possible. And when we're creative and we put creativity into action, then we're going to tap into our passions. So now when you have the intersecting points of creativity and passion, you now have purpose. And then when you have your purpose right, then you have to tap into the autonomy to be able to really deliver your purpose in a way that matters to you, which then taps into mastery and competence. Mm-hmm. We have to be good at what we do. So those five things all intersect and intertwine. And when we get those five things right, which you've done in your career, it's not like you're not thinking about what your next step is. You are kind of, when you think of Texas Hold'em, you know, poker, Texas Hold'em, going all in on passion and purpose and autonomy, giving yourself space to figure it out. And the mastery as a player came to you, but now it's the mastery of a coach. And then how you can begin that and turn that journey into creating that for your players, creativity and passion and purpose and autonomy and competence. And when you get those right, then the brain neurology, the brain science will take care of itself and kickstart certain neurochemicals to keep you motivated. Right.
Exactly. So you know, I'm a big fan of going out of the box is one thing, but you know, I'm really big fan of the creativity in playing the guitar, writing a song, writing a poem, try to do paintings. I think those things for me have worked nowadays. I know that I need it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when I'm stuck in a hotel in Japan, I still need some silent guitar to grab and a little bit, you know, get that into my brain, playing some songs or creating a song or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely 100% sure for us as a human beings, creativity in arts and sports and those two, three things together is the mixture for a nice life. Yeah. Outdoor living, you know, sports and stay creative.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. What a great way to end the show, Dagur. So I want to thank you for your time today. It's been great to reconnect. And as I said before we hit record, my family and I will go to Iceland eventually. And I hope I can play at least one round of golf with you.
And absolutely.
And then go look at a mountain and a big lake and just sit there and have a barbecue.
Sounds perfect.
Okay.
Nice to see you, man.
Yeah, you too. So just stay on the line. I just want to say goodbye to you. Yeah. But everybody, thank you very much for listening to this episode with
Dagur Sigurðsson.
thank you for saying your name, man. You know, I couldn't do that. But, you know, thank you very much for listening to this episode, and I hope you come back to listen to future episodes.
Listening to the Run Your Life podcast with host Andy Vasily.